think the American people ought to know that the challenges with respect to human source intelligence gathering in this era of Islamist terrorism is going to be a much tougher assignment than even cracking the Soviet Union in the heyday of Stalin and the Cold War.
Good morning. Let me start with sort of a little preview. In the fall, we are going to do a series of perhaps five forums on the collection, analysis, and use of intelligence. And we're working very hard to put together a connected series that I think will be interesting and very educational. Fred Hitz's book is the best primer that I have seen that would prepare one for the series that we're going to have in the fall. So anybody who wants to get a jump on the required reading, be ready for the pop quiz that we will have in September, should go ahead and get a copy of Fred's book either today or sometime convenient. Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Fred Hitz, the author of Why Spy? Espionage in an Age of Uncertainty, is a senior fellow at the Center for National Security Law and a lecturer at the University of Virginia School of Law. A graduate of Princeton University, where he was elected to Phi Beta Kappa, and of Harvard Law School, Fred Hitz joined the CIA and served in the clandestine service in Africa. After a stint in private law practice, he returned to government service at the State, Defense, and Energy Departments before he returned to the CIA in 1978. In 1980, he became Deputy Director for Europe in the Directorate of Operations, and in 1990, Hitz was appointed by President George H.W. Bush as the first statutory presidentially appointed Inspector General, a position he held until his retirement in 1998. Upon the occasion of Fred Hitz's retirement in 1998, Senator Arlen Specter, who was then serving as chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, said this from the Congressional Record. Fred Hitz was nominated by President Bush in 1990, confirmed by the Senate in October of 1990, and sworn in November of 1990. The Congress wanted a strong-willed and independent individual who was knowledgeable of CIA's mission, history, and activities, and who had the fortitude and skills to identify, investigate, and report wrongdoing when he saw it and how he saw it. Over the past 7 years, Fred Hitz has accomplished this mandate with honor and diligence in a sea of controversial investigations. Please welcome Fred Hitz.
Thank you, George. Thank you, sir. Well, I feel like I'm back home. I see so many faces, Jill students of mine, neighbors, friends, longtime Charlottesville acquaintances. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank you, George, for that kind introduction. In point of fact, I do think this book is a bit of a primer because that's sort of what I had in mind. After the terrorist attacks of 9/11, when we were sort of figuring out why we didn't have advance warning, and then subsequently in 2003, after we invaded Iraq, we wondered why there wasn't any, why the weapons of mass destruction that we were told were concealed in Iraq didn't exist. As you recall, a hue and a cry went up and said, where in the world are our spies? Why didn't we know more about what was going on? And in a lot of the things that were said at that time, the feeling that the Church Committee investigations in the late 70s had perhaps damaged the clandestine service beyond repair, the fact that we had begun to invest in a lot of gadgetry, and we do, We're talking about a budget now that is reliably estimated at $40 billion a year. That doesn't go into the paying of salaries, at least not the government salaries I'm familiar with. We handcraft these extraordinary eyes in the sky, the satellites, to spy for us, and they're terribly expensive, but they give the President of the United States real-time pictures of what is going on in critical areas of the world. Now, that's fine when you were talking about the missile test range in Central Eurasia, where the Soviets were firing off missiles during the Cold War. But that kind of intelligence gathering is less valuable at a time such as today, where you can make a chemical or a biological weapon in a closet, and there's nothing to photograph. There never has been anything to photograph, obviously, with respect to human beings and how they think and what they intend to do. So I think quite rightly, the American people argued after 9/11 that we have to do something to beef up our capacity to spy in the Middle East. We need to have agents on the ground. And the fact of the matter was, as all of the studies, the 9/11 Commission and the Senate study and the study by Chuck Robb and on the weapons of mass destruction area showed that we didn't have any spies on the ground. We didn't have any agents. Why didn't we? Well, the short answer to that, it's darn difficult. And I think the American people ought to know that the challenges with respect to human source intelligence gathering in this era of Islamist terrorism is going to be a much tougher assignment than even cracking the Soviet Union in the heyday of Stalin and the Cold War. Let's start with what a spy does, how you get into the business. If you are an American case officer sent overseas, what are you looking for? What kinds of chores will you have? I tried to break it down into sort of the seven deadly sins of espionage, what you're looking for in terms of human vulnerabilities and potential lures to work for the United States. And remember what we're talking about. We're talking about recruiting individuals who will betray family, betray friends, betray country, if country means anything, and in the case of Islamist terrorists, betray their cell. That's a tall order, especially if we're talking about those who have sworn to take their own lives, to martyr themselves, to advance their point of view. But traditionally, in the seven deadly sins, we've talked about ideology as one, and we have enormous successes to point to, as do the Soviets on the other side from the Cold War era. One I'll just speak to, someone called Rizard Richard Kuklinski, a colonel, became a general in the Polish military, and formed the view as a senior Polish military officer in the 60s and 70s that Poland would be the battlefield for any conflict between the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Pact, and NATO. The battle would be fought in Poland, and nobody in the command structure in Moscow was worried about how Poland would survive and what the casualties would be. And he looked for a way to make contact with an American military officer so that he could compare notes, so that he could begin to commune with the strongest power in NATO about what the Soviets were planning to do in hopes of saving his country. That was his motivation. That's his countrymen didn't look at it quite that way after he had to be brought to the United States, after he defected to the United States with his wife and two children sometime later, but they came to understand that his motives were pure. That's a kind of a way of describing an heroic spy, certainly heroic from our standpoint. More important perhaps today than in prior times is the issue of money. That's the second deadly sin: money help of a monetary kind. And Aldrich Ames, the spy who spied for the Soviet Union for 9 years after 1985, is an example of this. Aldrich Ames, it turns out, was a classmate of mine in spy school. I knew him, not terribly well, people. was a guy whose father was an academic, whose father had come into the agency in the late Cold War, hadn't been particularly distinguished, had a tour in Burma, I think, as a matter of fact. But Aldrich Ames had been raised with this. His mother was a high school teacher in McLean. And he was bright, no question about it. A lot of the, after he exposed and tried, some of those who worked with him said, no, he was a dim bulb and wasn't going anywhere. Well, that wasn't true at all. He was bright. He had the Russian language. He could handle officers well. He could agents well. He wasn't a recruiter, however. And that, in our business, was a key a quality to have. If you didn't have it, your career didn't advance terribly well. In any event, he got into trouble. He and his first spouse grew apart. He met an attractive Colombian lady when he was working in Mexico City, and he developed in his own mind this enormous need for cash. And he had decided at that time, perhaps he talked himself into it, that the rivalry between the Soviets and the United States was a phony one, that the United States was trying to build up its appropriation by painting the Soviets as a monster in the 80s, and he could afford to give away two or three cases that the Soviets probably already knew about and collect $50,000 to pay off his debts, get his teeth fixed, get rid of his Volkswagen, whatever it took to sort of to bring this lady of his life over to his side. So that was the beginning of his betrayal, and I just want to hold him out there as an example. There are other ways that relate to services that we can perform that, in lieu of money, that have the same effect. A very well-known senior official at CIA, Duane Claridge, wrote an excellent book that talked about his efforts at recruiting a Pole in Turkey, where it had transpired after a long period of exchange visits. Spy for All Seasons is the name of this book, if you should ever choose to read it. It turned out that this fellow's name was Adamski, Sava Adamski, and Adamski's wife became pregnant. And under the rules then existing in the Polish Foreign Service, he would have to go home. They'd have to return to Warsaw to have the baby. Well, they didn't want that, either of them. So what Dewey Claridge was able to do, he fielded a request from Adamski, his friend, for an abortion pill to help Mrs. Adamski abort her pregnancy. In the event, though, the pill was on the point of being provided, she aborted naturally, and the recruitment went on. But I mean, we're talking about the nitty-gritty of agent relations. Then the motivations become a little bit more obscure and a little bit mixed. Certainly, there is espionage for purposes of revenge. How many of you have seen the film Breach? Well, a smattering. And those who haven't, it's an awfully good film. Chris Cooper, who's the lead, plays Robert Hansen, the FBI spy, extremely well. And people wondered how an Opus Dei Catholic, which is what he was, seeking money for the tuitions of his children in Opus Dei schools, with no commitment whatsoever to communism. Indeed, a conservative, a hard conservative aversion to communism. How he could pass every secret he could get his hands on to the opposite side during a 20-year period of off-and-on espionage. Yes, he was paid money. He didn't get as much as Alder James, but he got enough to help with those tuitions. And yet, at the end of the day, he was an angry man. His skill was IT. He was very good at it. The Bureau used him regularly to solve intelligence communications questions, so there wasn't any normal boundary to what he was read in on the FBI. And he therefore was capable of betraying a whole range of secrets, such as the listening post that we had begun to construct close to the new Soviet embassy in Washington on Mount Alto. He gave that away at the cost of millions of dollars to the American taxpayer. He also provided information about how the FBI trailed Soviet diplomats at the UN in New York in order to keep track of them. So revenge. He was never a street agent type at the FBI, just as Alder James was never a field case officer who could recruit, and he wanted to get back at his colleagues in the only way he was able to do. Fourth is the notion of intimidation, whether it be blackmail as a consequence of a sexual compromise. It's something that the Soviets did against us a great deal, and were pretty good at it. They would catch some off-balance American diplomat in Eastern Europe who was lonely, and a swallow would come in. That's what they called these female case officers. From Russia with Love is a good tale of it in the Clancy terms, and boom, their liaison would occur, and out would come the photographs, and the diplomat would be confronted with that, and of course those pictures don't have to go anywhere if you'll cooperate with us. This was something that, as I say, the Soviets used, but we never did, and I think the reason was, it's not because we were goody-goodies, we and the British, we just, we didn't have any faith in this kind of intimidation or blackmail as providing a good basis on which to build an agent relationship. We also couldn't convince any young American officers or British officers to become swallows, but that's a different world. It wouldn't surprise you to know that another motivation is just out-and-out friendship. If you get to know somebody extremely well, you're sitting with a foreign intelligence service and your opposite number, and you are doing business constantly, there may come a time when you decide to take it one step further and sign that person up for a long-term relationship to spy. Something that's come into the news recently is the fact that the Chinese intelligence services try to collect information from American Chinese or Chinese in the United States. It's natural in their view. They're a great culture. They're a culture that's making strides forward. Why wouldn't a Chinese living in the United States take as much pride in that fact as people living in Beijing? And why wouldn't they want to help? And one of the most glaring cases of that was the Wenho Li case, which I teach about in my law school class, which is a situation where, if you'll remember, 4 or 5 years ago, the Congress did a study that showed that the Chinese were technically very active in the United States, trying to, through scientific delegations, collect a lot of useful information. And it also transpired they had discovered that, it had become the case that the United States at Los Alamos had developed a new design for a nuclear weapon, and that had gone missing. Well, boom, boom, one thing led to another, and the eyes of suspicion fell on a scientist at Los Alamos named Wenho Li. I'm sure some of you remember that name. And Li was a Chinese of Chinese ethnic extraction, although a Taiwanese by prior citizenship, and he was brought before Judge Richard Parker in Albuquerque, and the government said, you gotta lock this guy up, You got to put a ball and chain around his leg. You got to put him in solitary. He can't be permitted to speak to anybody because he has in his head secrets about our new nuclear weapon, which if they are passed to any enemy, will do us great harm. I even brought in big hitters from Washington to make this case. Fast forward 9 months. The FBI, having searched some of the surrounding dumps to find 10 magnetic tapes that allegedly Lee had absconded with from his office in Los Alamos, and not being able to turn them up, the case went to trial, and the 40-page indictment was reduced to one charge of not taking proper care of clandestine information. Surely, Wen Ho Lee was up to something. Unfortunately, we couldn't prove what it was, and the reaction of Judge Parker, having kept Lee in solitary confinement, and as I say, with a ball and chain around his leg, was outraged and lectured the government in open court about this. Nonetheless, ethnic and religious solidarity is also a very important motivation for espionage. And finally, my sort of favorite concept of them all, the notion of the game for the game. And I think in the case of Aldrich Ames, in the case of Robert Hansen, in the case of Kuklinski, in the case of others, Penkovsky, those cases, there's something about espionage where you are the person who knows what you're doing, but nobody else does, and you're right at the center of things. A very good read, though a read that will make you very angry, is the book that Kim Philby wrote about My Silent War in 1968 from the colds of a Moscow winter about his espionage. And you can read it as an understatement. I mean, it makes your hair curl how he eliminated the people in the path to promotion that the Soviets wanted him to take to become the head of the service, and he'd just find a way to undermine them. And he'd say, well, I knew things that they didn't know. But that characteristic, it's there. And if you want to see it defined, nothing's better than Kipling's Kim. It's the book I start my undergraduate course with. If you haven't read it for a long time, pick it up again. Remember, this was an Anglo-Indian who could pass. He was dark-skinned. He was able to get into native dress. He spoke the local languages, and that's what he liked to do. He'd like to go. He went to the bazaar and just hung out. And when things were happening, he took note of them, brought them back to the British. On many instances, they knew what they had. They trained him up to be a line man in a survey crew so he could go into the outback and observe. But there's some marvelous passages that say just this, that he loved the game for its own sake. Espionage is human nature. Human nature hasn't changed. All of these temptations, all of these vulnerabilities are still there, even if it's going to be very hard to get to them from the standpoint of approaching an Islamist terrorist. Somebody can. And what the challenge for the United States is to position itself, to get the access to these individuals so we can bring out some of these characteristics. To do that, all of us know in this room, you're going to need to know the languages. America is, it seems to me, eternally limited to one language, our own. We don't do that. And I think what's going to have to happen, President Bush wants it to happen, he wants a 50% increase in the numbers of hard language speakers in this country. But it's going to take more than that. We'll have to do it the old-fashioned American way. We're going to have to bribe people. And I think what we'll need to do is have stipends available at a significant level for a 5-year commitment to work in this area. And I think that should be able to work out. Same thing with respect to the culture. I would submit to you that Iraq was not an intelligence failure. in the essence of what went wrong. Yes, there were things about intelligence that didn't tell us what we should have known. And those, frankly, have been pointed out quite intensively during this period of time. But weren't we caught by not understanding the history of the region? Weren't we in a situation where we didn't even know how Iraq was put together? Now, I don't want to be flip about it, but I'll ask the question. How many of this in this audience have heard of Gertrude Bell? Okay, that is a fair showing. There's the person who we should have known about. Gertrude Bell, this, if I can say it, overage-educated British maiden lady, one of the early degrees from Oxford, had traveled in the Middle East, meeting all the people who counted in the former, what was soon to become the former Ottoman Empire, in the teens. And Winston Churchill turned to her at the end of the war, after the Sykes-Picot Agreement had divided up the former Ottoman area of the Muslim world in the Middle East, and said, we've got a possibility of controlling Basra and the area close to the Abadan refinery, which we have an economic interest in. The Anglo-Iranian Oil Company operates in that region. We definitely have to have that. We're also in a position where we're going to be given the mandate to run Mesopotamia. And there are a bunch of Kurds in the north that neither Persia nor the Turks are going to take, and we're going to have to deal with them. Figure it out. Figure out what we do. She came up with, drew the map and created Iraq. They persuaded a Hashemite noble to come to Baghdad, at least for some of the time, to reign, and that was Iraq. And after 35 years of dominance by the Sunni dictator Saddam Hussein, having taken over in 52, what in the world did we expect was going to happen after he was removed from power? How could we have believed that there would just be peace in the family and people would go back? Saddam would go on a Saturday and everybody would go back to work on a Monday. There were years of built-up grievances that were going to expend themselves in one way or another. So we got to know a heck of a lot more about the area, and I hope that that's on its way to being taking place. I've talked about access. It's not going to be white Anglo-Saxon Americans for the most part that are going to succeed in that area. And one of the areas in which we've tied our hands behind our back to some degree is the slowness with which we've approached the issue of first and second generation Arab or Muslim Americans. We've worried about the situation that exists for a good many of them, apparently with families still living in the Middle East with whom they are in contact. Could we look at them as being entirely trustworthy in this classified venture? And the answer to that is, we've already had this experience, thank you. We've read this chapter. It's what we did to the Japanese in the Second World War, and we've already ruled as a nation. If you're an American citizen, it counts for something. And you can, the answer is, you take them on until they prove that there's a reason that they shouldn't. And I'm happy to say that General Michael Hayden, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, said very much that thing last week at the dedication of the Richard Helms papers at Georgetown University. So we're going to do something about that. But the other thing that we have to worry about is our current reputation in the Middle East in particularly, but generally all over the world. I've studied this for a good while, the Cold War, and I can tell you that at least 80% of our batting average was due to the fact that we were the good guys. Nobody knew much about the United States. But they knew us in remote areas of the world. But they knew after World War II, we stepped in with Marshall Plan aid. We listened to the blandishments of our European allies and joined NATO, which was very un-American at the time. Usually we go home, but we refused to do that this time. We used our monetary, our economic, our financial preeminence, I should say, to stand behind the West German mark when it was first reissued. We were the go-to people. If you were opposed to Soviet aggression and to its movement west, the United States would be involved. We're not in that position now, as we all know. And in point of fact, although we're coming to recognize that we've got to improve our reputation, we have a lot of things out there that we haven't sorted out or that we haven't begun to live down. Torture, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, those words are going to be with us for a long time. And in the context of the intelligence world, there's an additional bit of baggage. And it's what is called extraordinary rendition. Don't you love the way Washington ties us down with these baffle gab phrases? Rendition was a very useful process, and it's been around for a long time. And it's one that we may have lost as a consequence of this extraordinary stuff, but rendition itself was a way for the United States or Germany or Pakistan or Kenya to cut through the extradition treaties between bilateral extradition treaties between the two countries. And when there is an accused of a bombing of an American embassy, get the government to allow us to take custody of that individual on the understanding that he would be remanded to the United States and tried in our courts. That worked well for a long period of time, for the period of time after the first George Bush presidency, when terrorism began to affect Americans. You remember the handicapped Jewish American citizen Klinghoffer, who was thrown off a ship, the Aquila Lauro, in the Mediterranean. Congress passed laws that made a terrorist act against an American overseas a federal offense, something that could be tried in American courts. And rendition was often the best way to get a foreign government to deliver that person to us. I have a personal stake in one. Mir Amal Khansi, who was the Baluchi shooter at the CIA gate when I was working there in the 90s. I came in the back gate that day. Just one of these horrific modern crimes. He'd been to the United States. I don't know how he got his visa. He was well-born. He'd had a degree in literature or something from a Pakistani university. He was a delivery boy in the United States, and somewhere along the line, he decided that the Israel thing meant too much to him, so he went to his local Kmart and bought an AK-47. Can you believe that? And went to the CIA gate, and as the workers started to come into work, he opened fire. Killed three people, wounded a number of others. But the point is, he was very quickly out of this country, back to Pakistan. Well, we went after him. It took us 5 years to track him down, the Bureau, CIA, and with the help of the ISI, the Pakistan Intelligence Service. There was a situation where it was very much in Pakistan's interest to deliver that individual to us. If they had to go through a long extradition process that was publicized, the politics of it would have gotten fairly heated locally. They gave him to us. We took him back here. He was tried in Fairfax Circuit Court, found guilty, and executed. So that, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but maybe it's too late. Extraordinary rendition is what we've done since 9/11, where we so-called have taken the gloves off. And what we're doing is apprehending individuals and sending them off either to their country of origin or a country that will cooperate with us, and they'll do the interrogation. They'll do the torture. We won't do it. They will, but we will get the fruits of it. And I got really hopped up on this after being asked to do a piece on the Arar case, Maher Arar, the Syrian/Canadian citizen who was lifted off of a jet at Kennedy Airport in New York. He'd been put on a watch list because the Canadians had given us inappropriate information. But without telling the Canadians what we were going to do, we shipped him off to Syria. We took him by private plane to Amman, cabbed to the Syrian intelligence service, in Damascus, where they beat him for a year with an electric cable and kept him in a cell the size of a tomb, and concluded after that period of time that he had no information. This guy is just as clean-cut a guy as you would see in any, you know, up-and-coming entrepreneurial iTech job. And he said, he testified to the Congress this fall, I was part of the group. I told them, if they sent me to Syria, I will be tortured. I have two young children. If they send me to Syria, I will be tortured. Canadians paid him $7 million. We have refused to talk to him. We haven't even taken him off the watch list. Still can't come to the United States. He testified by long distance. We are just taking a heck of a beating as a consequence. I still have close friends in the Canadian intelligence services, and to say there is a chilling in our relationship understates it. Well, I've got to get along here because I want to turn it over to you for some questions. I think we all know that the military can't be the only way to deal with terrorism in this world. One of the conclusions in my book is that the intelligence services, our intelligence services, are going to have to get a heck of a lot closer to law enforcement. The Bureau, the FBI, and CIA are going to have to work hand in glove. The 9/11 Commission was very articulate on it. They said we have to create an information sharing environment. The problem is they tried to legislate that. It can't happen. What you're doing is talking about breaking down the habits of a lifetime in both of these entities. The FBI doesn't talk to other agencies. They're preparing criminal cases for trial in federal court. They can't talk about evidence, but they push that very far. CIA, on its hand, says compartmentation, need to know. If I don't have to pass the ball, I won't. Well, remember what the 9/11 Commission concluded. They said their central finding was, in the context of 9/11, we, the U.S. government, was not set up for a terrorist act devised by foreigners overseas in Hamburg and Madrid, but intended to be executed in the United States. In other words, that has always been our division. The Bureau does domestic stuff, CIA and the DIA do the foreign intelligence work. That division just doesn't hold water in this particular time. As I say, the 9/11 and weapons of mass destruction intelligence failures were grave. Hopefully, the sharing of information mandates of the president have helped to deal with that. But I'm kind of a Judge Posner freak, this enormously bright judge in Chicago, Seventh Circuit, who feels he's not kept busy enough in his own court, so he dashes off a book every 6 or 8 months. And he made this point. Surprises happen. Guess what? Pearl Harbor. It was an intelligence failure, but if you look at it closely, it was a failure of comprehension. We just, although we'd read about it in Clancy novels, the notion of a suicide hijacker attack was new in our experience. Give you an illustration of this. I had a former director of the FBI named Tom Picard, who came to my Princeton class 3 years or so ago. He'd moved to Princeton, and he wanted a little retirement work. So I got him in to talk to our kids. And he said, we congregated, wrong word, we gathered two groups of pilots, 5 from United Airlines, 5 from American Airlines. Remember the two carriers that were involved in the 9/11 business. We asked them, how did the hijacker, the Al-Qaeda terrorists, get into the pilot seat? How did they make that change of control? Remember, you couldn't close the doors to the cockpit. That's been changed since. Did they kill him with the box cutters and yank him from behind the controls. How did they bring that about? And the answer from all, they met in two different groups, the American Airlines pilots, the United Airlines pilots. Every one of them said, hell no, we gave them the seat. Our instructions were the most important thing was to get the plane safely back on the deck. And if we had to go to another place, we'd do it. But we weren't used to dealing with somebody who was willing to give their life to bring it down. Well, there's a big change as a consequence of that. Let me finish up here. You do not solve these problems of intelligence gathering, human source intelligence gathering, by just moving the boxes around. By doing what we have done with the Intelligence Reform Act of 2004, which is creating a Director of National Intelligence, another layer of management on top, who's now busily cherry-picking all of the plum assignments, those involved with the President of the United States and top leadership from the working stiffs, and consider that a solution to the problem. And I think we're going to have to find, I think we're going to find that these things will change over time in the next administration. Let me give you some factoids about where we are in terms of numbers. It's not that CIA isn't an employer that the American people are not interested in. Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, General Hayden, said last week that in last year, the last fiscal year, 130,000 individuals completed applications to work at CIA. We're not talking about hits on a website. We're talking about completed applications, and believe me, I filled out that application. That is a pain in the neck. If you're going to do it, you got to be serious. So it's not a factor that we haven't got. It's the same sort of patriotism out there if it's appealed to as existed in the Kennedy era. But 50% of the onboard strength of the agency, of CIA, is new since 9/11. 50% of the analysts, those people who are looking over the evidence, trying to trap these bits of information, have been on their current assignment, whatever it may be, Iraq or China, for 2 years or less. The fact of the matter is we have suffered an enormous experience drain, and that's what we're going to have to try to remedy. And it's not made any easier by the fact that government salaries, which in my day you could be comfortable living on a government salary, and you weren't looking at people who were making 3 and 4 times what you were making and maybe working less hard. Today, and I think I'm safe in saying this, my students at the University of Virginia School of Law, if they want to go to New York or Atlanta or Chicago, can look to salaries of $150,000 to $175,000 a year. If instead they wanted to go into the general counsel's office at CIA, it'd be more like 40. And some of them are carrying substantial loans for their law school education. We got to do something about that. We're never going to raise government salaries up to an enormous amount, but that gap is too much. And a lot of us are thinking of ways to lure these outstanding young graduates into the service, and maybe they'll catch the bug. I never had a dull day in 25 years. But that's too much to ask. There has to be something there that deals with that money gap. I've talked for far too long, George, and I'm sorry, but with me, you knew that was always a possibility.
Fred, I'm going to go to the back of the room here in just a second, and I invite those who have questions to join me in the back, and we've got time to do a number of questions, and we are all interested in continuing this conversation. Let me start with this. There is a proverb, keep your friends close, but keep your enemies even closer. I've heard that attributed to the Arabs, to the Chinese, and to Lyndon Johnson. And I could believe it in any case. But keep your friends close, keep your enemies even closer. But recently, our national policy seems to have been, especially in the case of Iran and North Korea, to avoid bilateral discussions. Whatever talking we've done has been either through many people, the United Nations, or regional groups, but we haven't developed those bilateral relationships. How does the absence of these diplomatic or commercial relationships with our enemies impact our ability to collect useful intelligence, particularly human intelligence?
Oh, it impacts it very adversely. You're onto something there. I think the North Korean case is different from the Iranian case because I think the North Koreans don't have wide-ranging relations with anybody. Perhaps the Chinese. There's a substantial North Korean delegation in China, living in China. But that's a hard case. I think Iran, however, where you still have many, many Iranians who knew the United States, studied in the United States, wanted to study in the United States, had some contact, that we have been dragging our feet about looking for opportunities to talk to them. And as Jim Baker said when he was arguing about this in the Iraq study group report, remember, he said, you don't have to agree with them. You don't have to go in there and capitulate, but you do have common subjects that you can talk about. And what clearly one of them right now is, what do we do about this Shia issue in Iraq? As General Petraeus says, it's clear to him that Iran is underwriting some of the Shia opposition to the central government. Don't we have to talk to them to see if we can stop this? In any event, if espionage is the question, if we don't find a place to meet and deal with our opposite number, obviously we're not going to be able to form any relationships.
Okay. I would like to first of all to say that I enjoy your talk very much this morning. The question I have is maybe a corollary kind of a question. It stems from a review written by Robert Parry of a new book put out by Melvin A. Goodman, Failure of Intelligence and Decline and Fall of the CIA. I have not read the book, but there's a couple of comments which bear on the question I'd like to pose to you. And this is in the review. Apparently, in the early 1980s, CIA and analysts were seeing evidence of an accelerating decline in the Soviet Union, especially in its technological capabilities and its economy. Thus, Moscow seemed genuinely interested in detente with the West, especially a winding down of the dangerous and expensive arms race, the analysts concluded. From the book, apparently, this quote, a CIA paper warned of the Soviet Union's impending descent into economic stagnation. Soviet Economic Problems and Prospects was issued in 1977, setting out the reasons why the Soviet economy was in trouble and why its future was so grim, wrote Goodman in the book. So, again from the synopsis, when Reagan captured the White House in 1980, his followers set their sights on purging the CIA's analytical division of its historical commitment to objectivity, to be replaced by a submissive readiness to deliver politically desirable data. Okay, my question then is, if this and certain other alleged tailoring activities of pliable CIA policymakers, if this be true, whose mission ought it be to prevent the politicization of intelligence? I throw this question out as a rhetorical question because I know it's not an easy one. But it's a question that has bothered me and bothers many other people. And I welcome any comments you might have.
I think it's an excellent question. And the answer is multifold. Number one, and I'm going to your conclusion first, the president of the United States ought to want to have the straight dope. He ought to want to have the information, irrespective of whether or not, as a matter of policy, he's going to follow that lead. He ought to want to have the intelligence analysts telling it as it is. Secondly, if the Congress is now going to be involved in the oversight of the work of the intelligence community, then they have a job. They are made up, as you know, of Republicans and Democrats. They have a job to get to the bottom, too, of something like this. And we've seen, actually, during this George W. Bush administration, a real sublimation of the role of intelligence oversight. The committees just really haven't done a thing. And that's unusual, and the system won't work if that continues. That having been said, Mel Goodman, and excuse me for chuckling a bit, but Mel Goodman is a well-known protagonist. I happen to like him. He was a senior analyst during the period which he describes. He did feel that the management of CIA, especially Director Casey and Bob Cates, who's now, I think, an extraordinary Secretary of Defense, trying to pick up the pieces where Rumsfeld left them, were suppressing any information that dealt with the weakening of the Soviet Union. Now, I think what really is the case is the truth falls somewhere in between. Casey was a strong believer in taking the fight to the Soviet Union until communism was over. He stood behind the Afghan covert action where we helped the Mujahideen try to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan. He was fighting them in the beaches, fighting them in the air. Remember, he did this ill-fated Iran-Contra operation. So that was certainly his motivation. And Bob Gates, who worked for him, was sort of dancing on a hot plate there, trying to keep everybody popular. The fact of the matter is a lot of reporting got out, got to the president, suggesting that the Soviets were not doing very well. The key issue, however, turned out to be Gorbachev. And there were some that believed that Gorbachev was a person whom we would encourage and was going to go the distance. And there were others in the administration who believed that he would be beaten down and eventually overthrown by the KGB or some of the senior people. And you'll remember he nearly was. And that'll turn out Mel Leffler's written a terrific book on our own faculty, which talks about why opportunities weren't sought well before Gorbachev for the United States and the Soviet Union to get together and make peace. Well, Gorbachev was so far out on a limb that CIA, getting back to your point, was being criticized for not recognizing that there was a possibility that this would not succeed, that the bad guys would come in and throw him over and we would have been overcommitted to a solution that Gorbachev couldn't deliver. Well, in the end, he did deliver it. But I think your question on the essence of it, the obligation of the intelligence agencies to tell it like it is even more critical now in the Iraq-Iran days.
Sir, who made the decision to send Mr. Arari to Syria, and under what legal authority? I presume this wasn't just an agent in New York, and that there had to be some senior official who made this decision. And I also would like to know if it's possible for that to happen again, and anything you want to say on the Patriot Act.
Well, thank you for the question, and I don't know what happened during the week or 10 days that Arar was kept in custody at Kennedy in the hands of the Immigration Service was that hints got out that hints had been given to him that he might be sent to Syria. So he began to tell the Canadian personnel who were able to visit him that this was a possibility. And in point, our people on the immigration side who were aware of this suggested to the Canadian government that they intervene at a very high level to prevent it from happening. In the event, they had never seen an extradition carried out that quickly. They had had, as you can imagine, we have a lot of business with Canada all the time. And it was new in the experience of the Canadian authorities that the United States would move to deport an individual with that speed. So in that sense, just as the Canadians had given us bum dope to start with, they were a little slow off the mark to protect their own citizen. There is plenty of blame for them in this question. My point is they've recognized it. We haven't. The decision was probably taken because Arar was in the custody of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. They had possession of the body, so to speak. But I think it was the Bureau, FBI, and the CIA who said, look, this is a classic case for extraordinary rendition. Let's send him to the Syrians. He's a Syrian citizen. See if they can get it out of him. And remember, the law was so squishy at the time. The issue was whether or not we had a certain notion, whether we knew for sure that the Syrians would torture him. And what we sought to do in those cases was to get a letter back from some low-level flunky in the Syrian government said, oh, no, we're bound by the same human rights laws and treaties as you are. Well, it turns out that, of course, Syria was the top of the State Department list of torturers. So that paper wasn't worth what it was printed on. But it's this bonsai notion that you can get information by beating the daylights out of somebody that hopefully we'll see an end to come November. There's a former student of mine I want you to know, a naval officer, and an excellent student. How's your paper coming? Are we getting it to the right authorities?
Hope so, sir.
Good.
So. And I promise you didn't plant me with this question, but I'm curious, as a comparison and contrast to the Cold War era and today, you talked about we had one focus primarily in the Cold War era, and that was the Soviets. That's what the CIA was formed to deal with. Today, we're in a much more pluralistic situation. We have so many more regions and factions in which to focus. In the context of the human source intelligence, how is it that our leaders today in intelligence prioritize the human source intelligence with the wide range of factions and regions as opposed to the almost singular focus of the Cold War era?
Well, it's an excellent question. And I think you would know the answer as well as I. The Iraq-Iran thing is top of the list because that's where we've got our military forces pinned down. That's where we're really fighting it day to day. But I'm going to take your question as a lead into a follow-on that you hinted at. Is anybody minding the store with respect to China, let's say? And we've had some recent publicity suggesting that China still operates in this fashion of using trade delegations and the rest to get as much information as they possibly can. They're bound to. But along with learning Arabic as a hard language, I would obviously put in there Chinese as well. And Chinese is a language, thankfully, that's being studied quite widely in American universities. But China's even a tougher problem, because if you let the hardliners grab that problem the way they grabbed others, maybe we'll end up pushing China into becoming an enemy. I'm not an economist. I don't understand the trade flows as well as I should. But I think this is a classic case where, if you owe the bank $100, you've got a problem. If you owe them $1,000, the bank's got a problem. And I think the Chinese have every incentive to try to work things out with the United States because we're a customer that they can't do without at the present time, and they have a lot of our currency that they don't want to see go through the floorboards. We've got to be very alert to what the Red Army appears to be doing, the buildup of armed forces in China, and try to get an answer as to what's going on here. But my guess is the priorities are just the ones that you would suspect them to be. It's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. And it'd be a real mistake if we neglect China and a lot of other rising issues around the world.
Fred Hitz will sign copies of Why Spy? Espionage in an Age of Uncertainty following the forum. So let me ask everyone to remain in their seats and give Fred the chance to exit the room and get out to the signing station.
George, did we get all the gates locked so that nobody can get out unless they have a copy?
Good. Thank you.